From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 1st, 2018, when President Donald Trump announced his intention to impose a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports. Trump then tweeted, quote, "Trade wars are good and easy to win," end quote. A week later, he signed an official order to impose those tariffs. Since then, U.S. policy on tariffs has fluctuated. This past May, the Trump administration exempted Canada and Mexico. Other countries have negotiated steel tariff exemptions. Trump has said that part of his tariff plan is to reduce the flow of undocumented immigration, while part of it aims to improve the American economy. CNBC analyzed the impact of the Trump tariffs, and their conclusion was that the tariffs are the equivalent of the largest U.S. tax increase in decades. Well, last week on Connections, we sat down with members of the United Auto Workers. The UAW, as you probably know, is on strike, facing off with GM in what could be a long work stoppage. When we discussed tariffs, the UAW employees on the program were clear. They support tariffs, and they believe Donald Trump could win re-election if the president gets firmly and consistently behind tariffs. For the UAW, this is an issue that is central for American workers, especially in the Midwest. To be clear, the workers also describe Donald Trump as a con man, a serial liar who has never really cared about working Americans, but they expressed hope that the president would change his ways and support workers by, in part, supporting tariffs. And the door for votes is still open, they said. And that surprised some listeners, including, well, some union members who do not support tariffs, but other listeners who wanted to know more about these positions. So we asked the UAW to come back on the program to talk about it, the possible impact, and more. This hour, a conversation about what tariffs could do for workers, for consumers, and beyond. In studio with us is Dan Maloney, who is president of UAW Local 1097, and they are in day 10 of their strike. Welcome back. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
And with us in studio is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT, Amit Badabiel. Professor, thank you for taking the time as well.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, let me just start with the latest on the strike, because people care, they're listening, and they want to know what the latest is. From our perspective, it doesn't look like much has changed going on to day 10 now.
Correct. Our vice president is not going to negotiate through the press or social media, so they've been on radio silence on lockdown, but they are working, I'm understanding, around the clock in Detroit to come to a resolution. And we know one of the big hang-ups in the last hours here is the health care issue. GM wants us to pay for it, and temporary workers. We want to give temporary workers a path to permanency. It's the right, moral, and just thing to do, so we're not going back in until we fix it.
We talked about a week ago. Has anyone wavered in their position? When you talk to your fellow workers on the line there, how are people feeling?
Still feeling really good, and most of them think this was long overdue. We should have done it with when they took the taxpayer bailout. A few years later, with record profits in their pocket, we wanted, you know, again, our fair share of the pie that we bake. And folks here in Rochester, loss of pension, 30% pay cut, and we gave that. We are a stakeholder in this corporation. And the thanks we get was a letter last year, no new product for the Rochester facility. They're going to outsource it. More than likely, they didn't say where, but more than likely, China or Mexico.
Now, let's talk a little bit about tariffs, because that came up unprompted last week, and the workers we talked to from UAW were uniformly saying that that is something that workers support. And why don't you take us through your position on tariffs first, Dan?
Well, absolutely. So tariffs, we know, help level the playing field. We've lost the manufacturing base in this country. It's not because of expertise. It's not because of effort of the workers. It's not because of productivity, because we are some of the highest productive workers in the world with the highest quality. It's all about greed. So these corporations are like a plague of locusts. They'll go into a foreign country and abuse workers there. They circumvent the law of our sovereign nation by going to these foreign countries, pardon me, where they have no labor standards. Some of them will still use child labor, some of these countries. Environmental laws, it's the Wild West. And they've done a bunch of documentaries on what's going on when they break down electronics in China. For example, there's kids with soldering irons sitting there with mom, and they're snorting those fumes, breaking down some of our electronics that we ship over there. And they're coming down with all kinds of cancers and diseases at an early age. Corporations don't care, right? They're all about making a buck. at the workers' expense. So we want to stop that. And they owe the American taxpayer some jobs after we bailed them out through their bad management, right? Largest corporation in the world at one point. Again, more resources than some nations. They drove it into bankruptcy, right? The best and the brightest, the folks that are multimillionaires. Mary Barra, $22 million a year, hitting the lottery every year, making some bad calls, right? We're the stakeholder, the workers, the taxpayer, and they owe us jobs here in America.
What are tariffs going to do for you then?
So that'll help stop that circumventing of the law. So again, the only reason they go is it's cheaper. The only reason it's cheaper is because they don't have the standards that we have, labor laws, environmental standards,
et cetera. So when you look at tariff standards, are you thinking steel, aluminum, otherwise, what are the ones that matter most to UAW?
Manufacturing.
Manufacturing.
Altogether.
Yeah.
Three ways to create new wealth. I know we're sitting here with an economics professor. Grow it, mine it, or manufacture it. The greatest of those three by far is manufacturing due to the deep supply chain. Talk about the auto industry. Starts in the mines, bringing that ore up, going to the steel plants, the electronics, Pittsburgh plate glass, rubber industry in Ohio, all those parts moving around, the transportation industry, the engineering, the marketing, the sales. So for every auto worker, there's seven people working in the U.S., paying taxes, right? When those jobs go to China, every one of us gets laid off, seven other people. So you can see how quickly that would start a downward economic spiral. So we're here to protect the interests of middle-class America and the United States.
Now, before I turn to the professor for his thoughts on this, let me ask you what the impact would be for consumers. We briefly talked last week. You indicated that we ought to be willing to give up our insistence that all the goods we go to Walmart for are cheap. Mm-hmm. That I'm curious to know if you think Walmart itself is immoral, Dan.
From what I understand, the dad, back in the day, Father Walton, Walmart, yeah. He was a good American and proudly waved a flag, made America products on the shelves. When he passed, the kids took over, and they have some other folks running the country, a company for them. And, you know, there's a story, a book out, The High Cost of Low Price, an upside-down smiley face, talking about how Walmart drove the last, pardon my voice, I've been on a strike line.
I was going to say, I know you've been on the line. You don't have to apologize at all. Keep that water flowing. That's good.
So anyhow, the last U.S. manufacturer of TV tubes, they forced them out of business, all right, telling them you have to move from Ohio to China. We're not going to pay X amount. We're going to pay we're going to give you a lot less money for these TVs you're manufacturing. I think it was Quasar. And they sent them out to China where they could be made cheaper, and they closed down a company town in America. So again, they're circumventing our laws. That's why it's cheaper. And I thought we were all about expanding American democracy, not expanding communism in China.
But in terms of the actual tariffs, do you think that means consumers will have to get ready to pay higher prices?
Short-term pain, long-term gain. And again, look at the other side of the ledger, right? So I have to spend a couple more nickels for that trinket on a big box store shelf, but there's more people working, putting into the tax base, putting into buying consumer goods in America. More people are hiring, and they're putting into the tax base rather than drawing from it. Nobody looks at that side of the ledger, right? So we put people out of work here. They go on unemployment. They go on welfare. Maybe they go in, drug use, alcohol abuse, et cetera. There's a lot of cost, societal costs that go along with unemployment and job loss. So could avoid all that.
And the last point before I turn to Professor Badabial is when we saw the Trump tariffs come out, in various ways we've seen other countries respond with their own tariffs, trying to sort of offset or escalate this. So do you view tariffs as actually effective if other countries can retaliate in the same way?
We are the biggest consumer market in the world. Nobody can retaliate against the U.S. like we can retaliate against them, if you will. They need us more than we need them. So if we shut off, it's one-way flow from China. We shut off the spigot, right? They don't dump their finished goods on us. Again, some of the prices will go up on the shelves, but people are going to go into business and build those trinkets and manufacture goods once again, put people to work here. Our economy will boom. China would fail, So we're holding all the cards, being the consumer. They dump all their stuff on us. It's a one-way street.
Okay. Professor Badabiel, how do you view tariffs in the macro? And then we'll kind of get more specific as we go.
Okay. So there's a lot that Dan basically said here. So let me try to make a couple of bullet points out of them, and then we can get into whichever point you'd like to get into in further detail.
Okay.
So the first thing that I want to say is Dan has a lot of grievances about China specifically and the way in which the Chinese have behaved in the last 2 to 3 decades. There, he's spot on. There are many problems with China, and certainly in the trade realm, there's no question about that. But the key question then becomes, once you recognize that China has ABCD problem, what do you actually do to address those problems? And what President Trump has decided to do is basically use a single policy instrument and accompanied with threats to get China to behave the way he would like them to. And that single policy instrument is a tariff. So a tariff basically, and this is the second bullet point, a tariff is basically a tax on imports. So whatever you import from whatever country, China or anywhere else, the price of that particular good to American consumers goes up by the amount of the tariff, pretty much. There's a slight qualification there, but let's forget about that. So you have to ask yourself that if you are really interested in the welfare of workers, certainly in the United States, and more generally, everybody in the United States, are tariffs the best way to go about trying to do what you would like China to do? And the answer here is no, because the key reason is that the Chinese misbehavior that we see is on many different fronts, only some of which has something to do with trade directly. Let me be tangible on that. One of our pet peeves against the Chinese is that they do not provide market access to American firms. Okay? That does not have anything to do with trade directly. Second point is that they steal intellectual property from American firms. Again, valid point, but again, doesn't have anything to do with trade directly. Third, they force American companies, if they want to set up shop and do business in China, to mandatorily, as opposed to voluntarily, transfer the technology that they possess to the local Chinese affiliate. Again, clearly a problem, but again, trade per se doesn't have anything to do about it. And more generally, you have the problems of the Chinese saying, yes, 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 we will do A, B, and C, and then reneging later on and not following through on what they said. So we have multi-pronged issues to deal with here, and these multi-pronged issues have significant non-economic components to them. And so, for instance, intellectual property theft is, of course, an economic issue, but it's also much bigger than just being an economic issue. So when you address so many, or when you attempt to address so many different objectives, which are not, at least not all of them, directly connected with trade, with a single policy instrument, that's a tariff, typically, you're going to accomplish very little, certainly relative to the bigger objectives that one we typically have in mind. So one of the things that we learn in economics is that if you have 4 objectives in mind that you would like to accomplish, you typically need 4 policy instruments. In other words, the number of objectives, policy objectives, and the number of instruments used have to match up. Here, we see none of that. President Trump has said that he's tariff man, and he seems to think that he can accomplish every objective with just using tariffs accompanied by threats. And as we've seen now for over a year, that simply hasn't worked. And related to that, and this is the third bullet point, is a point that you alluded to a couple minutes ago, Evan, and that is retaliation. Here, the United States is the largest economy in the world, but it's interacting in its trade war with China, the second largest economy of the world. It's not a trade war with Fiji or some tiny country like that over which we can basically do whatever we want. The second largest economy of the world has means to retaliate, and they already have retaliated. So I would disagree with Dan's position that we are the single biggest consumer on planet Earth and then we call all the shots. We've already seen that the Chinese have stopped buying major agricultural produce from the United States, example soybeans, and as a result, American farmers are hurting. Now, that's just one example, but the general point is the ability, even of a country as large as our own, to extract concessions from another country, particularly when it's the second largest economy of the world, using a single policy instrument when the problems are manifold, is not going to accomplish a whole lot. And we've basically seen that thus far, tit for tat.
All right, so a couple of points before we get some feedback from listeners. Number one, do you agree with Dan, or do you understand Dan's point when he says, when you look at Walmart, when you look at the American habit of looking for the cheapest and the cheapest and the cheapest, what that does is eventually it hurts the American worker, because the American workers are working with different standards here. And if we're just looking for the cheapest, inevitably we, through our buying habits, are pushing jobs to other countries. Is that a fair point?
In principle, that is. But, you know, we have to ask ourselves that, you know, sovereign American consumers have the right to purchase wherever they want to and whatever they want to. They don't have to shop at Walmart. Walmart's not forcing them to shop at Walmart. The reason why they shop at Walmart, people in the lower end of the income distribution, is because they find A, cheap products, and these cheap products have reasonably, not superb, reasonably good quality. We could, for instance, say that, you know what, these products coming in at the lower end of the, quality spectrum, whether it's toys or clothes or shoes or whatever, we think you've manufactured these goods with substandard labor, and these labor regulations that you have in your own country would not pass muster in the United States. So we're not going to have these goods in our country at all. So that would be an import ban on certain products.
Why not do that?
We could. But then we have to ask ourselves the same question. Who's helped? Who's hurt? The reason why a lot of people continue to shop in Walmart is because they see benefits, right? No one's compelling them to shop at Walmart. They have choices. They could buy American products. They could buy Filipino products. But the reason why they continue to shop at Walmart is because wearing their consumer hat, they clearly see benefits.
Okay, but before I turn back to Dan here, when you say typically in the economic theory is if you want four different outcomes, you need four different instruments, not
right.
just tariffs.
Right.
So if one of the things that you want is to not be in a situation where you and I go out to a store and we're buying products that were maybe made by children or in substandard labor and environmental conditions,
mm-hmm.
then is a not just a tariff, but a ban on anything without our environmental standards, is that a different tool that could be used effectively?
That could be used, but what I would suggest, and I'm sympathetic to Dan's concern here about the plight of American workers in the last 30 or 40 years, because many of them, certainly in manufacturing, which he knows a lot about, have been decimated by trade with China. There's no question about that. So what we should do is the following. We should tell the Chinese, when we, the United States, played a huge role in getting you admitted to the World Trade Organization, you made a bunch of promises. In particular, we treated you with kid gloves, meaning we allowed you to join the WTO as a developing country, although that's a laughable proposition now that China's a developing country. But because you're a developing country, you can have relatively high import duties and tariffs against our goods, but we will not do the same. But our understanding is that over a period of time, you will change your behavior and play in a manner so that the level of the playing field is more level. That is what has not happened. And this is the part of reneging that I was talking about. The Chinese made a bunch of promises which they just have not followed up on. So we should tell them that, look, this is what you promised and you haven't delivered. So what we're going to do now is we are going to cooperate with some of our other Western and non-Western allies, example, countries of the European Union, many of whom face the same issues that American workers and American firms face, and say, here's a joint US-EU view on China. This is what we think you're doing wrong, A, B, C, D, E. You better shape up on the following A, B, C, D, E points. And if you don't, then we will take joint action against you. That would have really gotten Beijing's notice. But President Trump has done nothing of the sort because he doesn't believe in diplomacy.
Okay, Dan, do you look at the tariffs that the Trump administration instituted about a year and a half ago and conclude that The goal, as I understand it, is your view is that American companies have been willing to sell out American workers just so they can make goods cheaper, even if that means kids going on the job or people breathing in fumes and dying young. They don't care. That's how you feel. So if the goal is to make it such that those are not the conditions in China, that they will raise those standards, they will raise environmental and labor standards, they'll raise pay rates, and therefore the goods will get quote-unquote more expensive, that will open the door to say, okay, well, now we can compete. We're going to do that here. Mm-hmm. And even if the price on the shelf is more, there's more people with jobs and disposable income to buy them. If that is all part of the goal, do you look at the last 18 months and say, the tariffs just haven't done it?
Well, again, he's the president, con man in chief. Like we said, he's just puffing up. Everything that he's done so far has been more bluster than actual policy. And I do agree with the professor that he has screwed up diplomacy across the globe. He's ticked off, for lack of a better term, all our allies that we've held dear since the First World War, Second World War, right? Britain, France, the European Union, and absolutely in Canada. They have very similar standards to the U.S., labor standards, environmental standards, and a lot of times higher, right? For lack of a better term, we are Europe's Mexico. That's why some of those automakers come to the U.S. to produce vehicles. So we have cheaper labor, and again, our productivity is second to none, the American worker. So I agree with the professor. If we had somebody else in the White House that actually knew a thing or two about diplomacy and bring all that kind of pressure to bear on the bad actors in the world, like China, we'd be in a better place, along with using the tariff as part of the tool, because with no financial spanking, for lack of a better term here, right, they're not going to fall in line. So we do need that tariff as part of the bigger picture, along with the diplomacy that's been sorely lacking with this president. So, again, it's they just flood our markets. We saw it, the dog food poisoning our pets, the lead and the radon in the cribs and the children's toys. It's beyond illegal and immoral. We should have shut them off and banned those goods for years after that kind of stuff was found.
Okay, but you also were part of a panel last week that said, as much as you view this president as, quote, the con man in chief, mm-hmm. you think American workers, knowing all of that, would still be willing to vote for him. Let's say he's still president next year. They're still willing to vote for him for re-election if he doubles down on tariffs and commits to them long term.
Yep. Now, this is not an official position.
I understand. You're speculating on the mentality of workers.
Right.
Danda, in this moment, is not speaking for all unions, and I get that there's diversity of thought here. But everyone I talked to from UAW said, yeah, American workers might still vote for him if he really doubles down on tariffs.
So he's a con man, and he could pull off the big con if he actually did. Lock down Chinese goods and start reopening those factories in the U.S. like he promised. Buy a house in Ohio. Those jobs are coming back, quote, end quote, right? He lied. So they shut down Lordstown, and those folks know he lied. He knows Ohio's an important battleground state. He knows Michigan's an important battleground state. And again, the strike going on is they're seeing the signs of a recession for Michigan right now. If the economy doesn't hold out, the jobs aren't there, he loses in a landslide in 2020.
He did better in 2016 with organized labor than any Republican has done in a long time. He mm-hmm. won organized labor in Ohio, a state that I'm from, and yep. growing up, people wouldn't have thought that was possible. Why do you think he was able to do it?
It was just that, the promises, unfulfilled promises,
but what
AKA
do you think labor?
Lie.
Okay, I hear yep. that, but what about, have the Democrats lost labor in some ways?
Yeah, we felt betrayed. I'm a Democrat, right, by these global trade laws and free trade. Again, there's nothing free about it when it's costing us jobs. And we talked about in the manufacturing sector on the show I was here last, the greatest generation was able to win two world wars only because we could outproduce our enemies. At that time, when you study history, the Germans and the Japanese had some better weapon systems, but they couldn't produce them as fast enough and in the quantity that America could. So we wore them down, outlasted them, and kept the world safe for democracy, right? So the greatest generation, hats off, it was my dad and my uncles that fought in that war. And we are the arsenal of democracy. So we've gutted the arsenal of democracy. So now our ability to defend ourselves is weakened, and our economic prosperity is weakened. And again, we're weakening the position of American democracy across the globe, and we are funneling and channeling money to expand Chinese communism. that's just wrong on every level, and it needs to end.
Professor, you want to respond, and then we'll get some feedback from listeners.
Yeah, so there are many, many different points that one could make in response to Dan's comments. And one of the things that I would like to say is that all of this discussion about economics and tariffs in particular should not obfuscate one central point. And that one central point is that many Western thinkers, politicians, academics, observers, etc., believed in their hearts that economic liberalization will lead to political liberalization. In other words, if we open China up to the rest of the world, and that's one key impetus for making them member of the WTO, they will learn to play the game that we Western nations and other nations play. And this playing will eventually, or inevitably in the minds of some people, lead to political liberalization, meaning the death of the Communist Party. But that hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. So as a result, some people continued to hope, hold out hope that this was going to happen in the face of all contradictory evidence. But now we're at a situation where I think it's a bipartisan consensus amongst both Democrats and Republicans that the Communist Party ain't going anywhere anytime soon. We're going to have to deal with them, and they're not going to change their ways. The only language they understand is that of pressure, severe pressure, and force. That is why I said a couple minutes ago that if we had banded together with the European Union and told them, look, these are our concerns. We believe they are legitimate. You better act otherwise. And the otherwise being, we will pretend, we meaning our joint impetus that we're talking about, as if China doesn't exist on planet Earth. We will not sell anything to you. You can find whatever you want elsewhere. Go to Korea, Philippines, whatever. We will not sell anything to you. You don't exist to us as a market. So a very high-powered consumer boycott. But of course, nothing of the sort has happened because President Trump has, attacked our EU allies, Canada. He called Canada a national security threat once. I mean, it's just utter nonsense.
So one other question for the professor, but then we'll get to the feedback here. Economists, generally speaking, don't like tariffs, or they don't like tariffs in an isolated sense in the way that you've talked about, as some sort of a magical instrument that's going to change everything, and for the reasons that you've outlined. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions, but that's generally a pretty broad consensus among conservative economists, more progressive economists. American workers, and again, I'm going to generalize here, sometimes feel like there's a disconnect between economists and the people on factory floors.
Right.
And they feel like, I get the points you're making, but ultimately here, we have to draw a line in the sand at some point and say, these are about jobs. Do you think American workers have to accept the fact that manufacturing is slowly leaving, sometimes quickly leaving our country and not coming back? Or do you think we can rebuild the actual production sector in this country realistically, Professor?
Right. So I think manufacturing as it existed in the United States in the 1950s and 60s is essentially gone. And it's not going to come back. Or it's going to come back at very high cost, and it's unclear whether American voters are prepared to pay that cost. So that's one point. The other point is, whenever we talk about an American worker or an American citizen in general, and you ask whether a tariff is good for him or her, you always have to remember that the worker doesn't live in isolation. The same worker wears a consumer hat. The same worker is part of a society in which there are other people working in allied industries relative to this particular worker. So if you look narrowly at the impact of a particular tariff, so let's take, for example, the tariff on steel.
Yep.
So we have a tariff on steel, so if I look at its impact directly on American workers in the steel sector, they benefit in the short run. But however, these very American workers face certain problems. So when American steel begins to look competitive because there are tariffs on foreign steel, what's going to happen? You're going to have demand for American steel go up. Now, American steel producers can do one thing here. They can raise prices because they know that they have no competition, or at least not the kind of competition that they face. So they raise prices. That means their revenues go up, the firms, their revenues go up. But does it help workers? If they have the ability to raise prices, are some of the increased revenues passed on to workers either in terms of subsidies or higher wages or something of the sort? There is no evidence to suggest that that in fact happens, except maybe in a few isolated instances. Moreover, even if the firm does not have market power, I'm say an American steel producer does not have market power, the short-term demand for increased American steel hides the fact that many other industries are also going to be affected by that tariff. So because steel prices have now gone up, complementary industries that use steel as an input, example, automobiles, their prices are now going to go up because the cost of a vital input, in this case, steel, has gone up. So when the prices of autos go up, does that help or does that hurt Americans? Well, if you're a factory worker on a GM in a GM plant, you may be helped wearing your worker hat, and I say may. It's not clear that you definitely will. It depends on what kind of collective bargaining we have. But wearing your consumer hat, you will definitely be hurt unless you don't buy anything at all upon which tariffs exist. So when you consider the fact that an American worker or an American citizen more generally wears multiple hats, they gain from the perspective of some hats, but then they lose from the perspective of other hats. So then the question becomes, what's the net picture? And the central economics result is that you can show that free trade is better than any kind of managed trade, whether with quotas or tariffs or something else, in the sense, and this is the important part that I would like to emphasize, that the winners win by more than the losers lose. And that's where economists stop. But that's where politicians need to enter. Because when you say the winners win by more than the losers lose, what you're saying is that the winners win by so much, I could take some of their winnings, transfer that or redistribute it to the losers, and we would still come out on top. But it's the transfer and the redistribution that never actually occurs. And that's why workers, in large part, are in the position that they currently are.
So they need protection policy.
They absolutely need certain kinds of protection. And generations of politicians, both Democrat and Republican, have promised that but delivered nothing. That's why in 2016, workers are saying, hey, like President Trump said to black people in the Detroit area, what have you got to lose? That's what some of these workers are feeling like. Hey, we've seen what happened to us with both Democrats and Republicans in the last 3 to 4 decades. Why not take a chance on a businessman? He seems to talk right, and he sure talks our language. What could be worse? Well, we've seen what could happen once you take a chance on such a person.
So there's some agreement there, at least on that last point.
Absolutely.
We're going to talk about in our next half hour, we're going to take some phone calls. We're also, I want to get thoughts from our guests about one other interesting point. When you look at public opinion of organized labor and collective bargaining, it's at its highest levels it's been in a long time. And the question is, why do our guests think that is the case, and what do they see as the future of collective bargaining in this country? So we'll hit that as well. Our guests, Dan Maloney, who is the president of UAW Local 1097. They are on their 10th day of strike against GM, and Dan says they are prepared to go one day longer and one day stronger. Look, I'm not on the picket lines with them, but I think that's what they keep saying. And they say if it's a long haul, they are ready for that. Professor Amit Banabiyal is here, a professor of economics at RIT, and your feedback is next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we sit down with a woman named Sadai, who was 12 years old and survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. She takes her message around the world now, warning against weaponry, nuclear war, and what humanity is capable of when humanity is at its worst. Her remarkable story of survival and the lessons, Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Assemblyman Mark Johns is on the line, calling the program. Hi, Assemblyman. Go ahead.
Well, look at Evan twice in 2 weeks here.
Hey, anytime
hey,
you want.
Professor. Good to talk to you both. Look, I just wanted to throw some stuff in. Number one, Ronald Reagan, back in the 80s, before we had the World Trade Deal, put 100% tariff on steel imports, brought Japan and Brazil and other countries to their knees. Steel imports are gone now, or at least they were faded away under Reagan, but it got the message across. Then he put 100% tariffs on Harley-Davidson, imported motorcycles from Japan to protect Harley-Davidson. Harley-Davidson was going bankrupt. The jobs are going to be gone. guess what? Those jobs are saved. It's still an American company. We don't want to lose manufacturing jobs. We don't want to lose technology. And when they saw that Reagan was serious, they said, hey, you know what? We're going to start at least doing final assembly of Japanese cars here in America. And that's why you have a lot of transplants. Now some German and European cars are at least the final assemblies being done here. Now, they're non-union jobs, which I prefer they be union, but that's okay. At least
amen.
It's at least it's jobs here. But the point is, we lost that ability to do it. We had something called Super 301. People don't remember. It was Section 301 of the trade deal. Super 301 is when you could just unilaterally put a tariff on now. You can't do that anymore. You got to go to the WTO over in Geneva, Switzerland, where nameless, faceless bureaucrats that may even have stock in some companies that we don't even know about make the decisions. And that's what Trump's talking about. And Trump is a bumbling fool. He speaks with a sixth grade education. He can't speak English. But I understand what he's trying to get at. And Clinton and President Clinton, the Clintons were the ones that pushed this. This happened under their watch. And then what happened when George Bush came in? Nothing. Obama came in? Nothing. Trump said the right words, and then he starts fighting with all our allies. Instead of, he should have said, look, at who's the number one bully? Who's the number one country that's stealing our intellectual properties, our patents? It's China. They should have said, look, we got differences with Europe, Canada, Mexico. We should have got the whole world organized against China, sent a message, said, look, you're going to start playing by international rules. We're not going to allow you to get away with what you got away with. You're the second largest economy. You're not going to play like some third world country. And if we would have united our partners, I mean, I give Trump credit for at least trying. No other president has tried. Well, maybe he won't succeed. But you know what? If you try and start a trade union over in China, you're going to be the next involuntary organ donor.
But
I'll tell you what, they're gonna harvest your kidneys before they put the bullet through your head.
Assemblyman Jones, before I let you go, how do you feel about calls in various states across the country? And obviously it was sort of the most politically dramatic in Wisconsin, but calls to make states right-to-work states.
Look, we cannot try and make New York State or any other state a workers' paradise. These things will work themselves out when we have a level playing field. Jobs may not happen in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, but jobs will come about in New York or in United States when we start leveling the playing field, and it's the World Trade Deal that doesn't allow that. And 75% of both parties voted for the WTO. A lot of them got kicked out of office. You know what they're doing now? They're foreign lobbyists. I mean, unbelievable. And you know what? When the majority of automobile passenger cars in this country are foreign nameplates, why doesn't a president come out and say, you have a choice?
Do you feel
can
like
buy American. You don't have to.
Dan, do you feel like that's a strong enough answer on right to work?
No. So right to work, it's the only place that you're going to find where we have to provide a service and not get paid for that service, right? And it's an outright effort to undermine the union movement, to defund unions, and to try to shift the game, right? We're the only force that can stand up to the business community, like we're doing now against General Motors, and stop that rampant greed and abuse of workers across the globe.
So, Assemblyman, does that mean, Assemblyman, that you're against making New York a right-to-work state?
Yes, I'm pro-union, but my point, I'm talking about the bigger picture.
Sure, I understand.
I agree with Dan. Look, I get union support. I appreciate it. But you know what? We have a choice. And Dan will tell you all the time, you got union strong stickers on the back of Lexus. You got vote for this Democratic candidate, and they're driving around in foreign cars. I mean, let's quit pretending to be for the union workers and all these slogans. Let's go out there and actually try and help each other. Buy washers and dryers, refrigerators and stoves made in America with American companies that pay American taxes, which will wind up paying your pension or your Social Security.
Assemblyman, always nice to hear from you. Thank you for taking the time.
Good luck, guys.
Well, that's Assemblyman Mark Johns calling the program. Let's get a different perspective. This is John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I agree with a lot what Assemblyman John said, except the right to work issue. I think right to work should be imposed on public employees. That's one of the reasons our state is in such decline, is the government dole of public employees. I don't necessarily have that same viewpoint on Dan Maloney's union, private unions that deal with private companies. But I wanted to say that, you know, Trump really is the only president, as Mark had said, that I can remember, that really took the bull by the horns and decided to deal, number one, with Red. I still call them Red China, and they're vicious. And not only economically, they're building up their military worldwide, and it's a scary thing. And Trump's the only one that's taken them on in a big way. So tariffs against China, I think, are definitely justified. And the other is he's dealt with Mexico on trade. He's dealt with Canada on trade, the European Union. He's put them on notice. We're not going to put up with this anymore. And I think the professor, to a certain extent, is in a dream world, because this is the philosophies that our previous leaders have taken against these so-called trade partners, and they've taken advantage of us. Not only China, but the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. It's about time somebody's taking a bull by the horns. Is not going to back off.
But John, you've got Dan Maloney here, and Dan says right to work really means right to work for less or not at all.
I disagree with that, Dan. But I, like I said, I think it should apply to the public employees. That's our biggest problem here in New York State is the public employee. It's not the private unions. It's not the AFL-CIO.
Well, do you want to see more organized labor in this country, John?
I do not, because we have so many different local, state, and federal labor laws that have been in effect, and only for a short period of time. We have some unbelievably good labor laws now to protect workers.
How do you feel about the income inequality in this country, John?
The income inequality, the solution to that is put more resources in the hand of the private sector. Right now, there's too many resources in the hands of the public sector, which is very inefficient. You put the more resources in the hands of the private sectors with tax cuts, et cetera, it will blossom.
All right. Thanks, John. On the subject of just tax cuts blossoming, we have seen massive tax cuts in the Trump administration. Professor Badabial, what are the results we've seen so far?
Well, the results are, as the caller just mentioned, that if you take more money and give it to the private sector, there's going to be even greater inequality. I mean, the result of what we've observed as far as income inequality in the last 3 to 4 decades is concerned is precisely because we have a lot already in the hands of the private sector. And we've seen what the private sector does with it. It generates wealth, there's no question about that, and it works very well for some Americans, but the proportion of those Americans is becoming very, very small. And I'd like to pick up on the earlier point about Trump being the first president to actually take the bull by the horns. It may seem that way, but I would urge the caller to look around him and find any tangible results that have come about as a result of his seeming ability to take the bull by the horns. In fact, what we have is massive chaos all around us with nobody giving ground, certainly not China, not yet. In fact, what I would suggest is, and as I have already suggested, is that multilateral diplomacy is the way to go. You don't pick. Yes, we have differences with France and Germany and Canada over relatively minor matters, relatively minor relative to China, that is. But you don't make enemies of the entire world and then say you're Mr. Tariff Man and that you're winning. You're not. The world is laughing at you and recognizing you for what you are. That is a blithering idiot.
John, thanks for the phone call. And to the professor's point, the evidence tends to show that when economic wealth is concentrated in the hands of a relative few, it doesn't circulate very much. The notion, and again, this isn't meant to be a political or partisan comment. When What's the name of the CEO you keep mentioning?
Mary Barra.
I mean, when the wealth is concentrated in the hands of the few, they don't always reinvest it in their companies. They don't always give their workers raises. The reason that Dan Maloney and the unions have existed is because the hope that John has that that would lead to better worker pay and and benefits doesn't always bear out. Fair, Professor?
Yes. I mean, the recent evidence marked by Thomas Piketty's wildly successful book is that if you look at the two basic factors of production that are typically used to manufacture anything, and I'm going to focus on capital broadly and labor, over time, the returns to capital have been going up dramatically relative to the returns to labor. So in simple English, capitalists have been doing very well, laborers have been doing relatively poorly. And we need to have in place policies that will address that particular question and the increasingly vast divide between the so-called 1% and the remaining 99%.
Dan, you consider yourself a capitalist?
It's mixed market capitalism is what's worked in this country for a while. You have to have balance, and the labor movement helps balance off the more base instincts of a pure capitalist society. So we help share the wealth with the laborers that create the wealth.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right now we see public opinion of labor, the labor movement, unions, at the highest level we've seen in a while. Why do you think that is, Dan?
Because people have been squeezed over the last couple decades. I believe they said it was the Powell memo compounded by Ronald Reagan taking on the air traffic controllers that weakened the labor movement, that emboldened the capitalist to go on the offensive, on the attack over the last 30 years. And it's true that when they get richer and they hoard that wealth and they put it in offshore, untaxed bank accounts, it does no good for the working class or for the society or for our, you know, our states and, again, American democracy. They're gutting it for pure greed, and we need to bring it back. It's the right thing to do. Share the wealth. Again, that's all we're asking for, a share, fair share of the pie that we bake, period. And
okay.
We intend to get there one day longer, one day stronger.
Professor, how do you feel about public views on labor improving in recent years?
I think that's Dan alluded to some of the points. I mean, what we've seen in the last 30 to 40 years is a decline not only of the labor movement, but laborers absolutely doing worse relative to their capitalist peers. And that's all around us for to see. So that frustrates a lot of people, including regular American workers, because most do not belong to the 1% and actually work with their hands, their feet, their mouths, their brains, etc., to put food on the table. So they're not sitting there investing and trying to figure out what the financial gains for that week have been. What we see here is that the returns to people who actually manufacture things, that is, make things, is not valued anywhere near as the returns to those people who play with paper. And I'm being partly facetious here, but the symptomatic of the broader point that the returns to manufacturing and a recognition of what manufacturing does for the economy has declined. So now, you know, the shoe's on the other foot, if you will, and people are beginning to see that, hey, it's really not possible to have a broad-based, thriving economy with only the financial sector doing very well and the rest of the country not doing so well. And that is in part what explains this returned, newfound appreciation for making labor and labor unions stronger than they have been in the recent past.
We've seen this in history before in France, right, with Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. We know what happens with wealth inequity. Throughout history, it's not good for any economy. It's not good for any country. We need to have the shared prosperity that will make this nation stable, steady for decades to come. And that's what this movement is all about.
I know I keep asking you this, Dan, but people keep wondering here. I mean, is there a point where if this strike, the UAW strike, if it gets to a certain point, is it really going to start hurting workers? And do you expect any defections?
No, we're absolutely, people are still on cloud nine. Every 4 years when our national agreement comes up, we've been getting smaller and weaker. Every 4 years, smaller and weaker. If we didn't take them on now, there'd be nobody 4 years from now. Again, we got our pink slips, if you will, last August when General Motors said next generation work will not be made in Rochester. That's your thanks for us stealing your pension and cutting your pay 35%. That's the thanks to the American taxpayer. So we had to take on this fight. And the community support has been overwhelming. It's unbelievable. People dropping off cases of water, food items, donuts, pizza, all that, telling us, coming by, honking their horns. Come by the strike line sometime. It's 24/7, and you'll see.
Where's the line? Tell people where the line is if they want to see you.
So we're out in front of our General Motors plant on Lexington Avenue and on Driving Park. It runs between Mount Reed, both of those roads, Lexington and Driving Park along Mount Reed.
And so last, feel free. Last question. The professor responded to John's comment. How do you feel about John saying, hey, the president is sending a message to these countries around the world. He's fighting for the American worker. He's rattling that saber.
Again, I just feel that he's trying to get reelected. You know, he passed that tax cut for the wealthy. They already have much. They did not need more, right? Again, he should help end this inequality of income and help redistribute it somewhat. And I'm not by any means talking a communist socialist redistribution of wealth. I'm talking about a fair share of wealth that we earn.
Well, Professor, when you talk about redistribution, people always assume it goes redistributing from up to down. We redistribute wealth plenty in this country on the way up.
In the other direction. Let me just make one 30-second point. We've forgotten to discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a singular achievement of the Obama administration, which excluded China because all the 12 participating countries recognized that there are problems with China and we need to band together. What did President Trump do? Junk it within the first month he was in office. I don't think he even read the agreement.
Professor Amit Badabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Maloney, you can find him out at the strike line, the president of UAW Local 1097. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Don, Emma Ray, Megan Mack, and the entire Connections team. I'm Evan. We'll talk to you tomorrow.